Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. Billy Steele. Tonight we're going to I've got a couple of we're gonna do a couple of things. I've got I was kind of put off by the elections recently. I think everybody in the United States is, but what's happening in this country is this goes against, just seems to go against everything that is right. I mean, I was hopeful. That was a few years ago, rather optimistic for a while about Obama's election and, you know, where I thought the country was going to go, which way it was going to go. And it seemed to be headed in the right direction, but I guess the problem is that when you deal with these kind of issues, with so many people, you never know what you're going to get. Kind of like Forrest Gump, you never know what you're going to get, like a box of chocolates. And in so many respects, that's true. I've always been proud that I'm a liberal, and I'm gonna admit that I've always have. Although I'm an independent, politically independent. I believe in liberalism. I believe in the freedom that we should have as individuals to believe in the goodness of mankind, believe in the betterment of mankind, believe that mankind can be better, should be better. But I haven't seen that progression in the last many years, especially in American politics and pretty much all over the world. And to me, there's only one real answer, and it's the answer of I don't even know what the answer is, really. I've always thought it was believing in the Enlightenment, believing in knowledge, possibly believing in people to some degree. But people are so disappointing.
Thousands of them were brought here.
Nazis who committed these horrendous and horrible crimes against their own people and against humanity, and were given new identities and brought into this country and as spies and I won't go into the whole thing. I'll be interviewing Mr. Loftus in a couple of weeks. But reading the book is so troubling because once the veil is stripped, that innocence, that idealism, that you want to believe. Tonight I have actually two readings for you, and I was going through some of the letters and writings of Thomas Jefferson, and recently, and shortly after the selection, and I chose tonight to read this. It's rather brief, but it's. First inaugural address by Thomas Jefferson, and this was in March 4th, 1801. Now, he won the election against John Adams, and it was a very bitter and hard-fought election, and one that became, from friends. And friends, but power and political partisanship and philosophies separated the men. And oddly enough, they both died on the same day, 4th of July. They were both around 80 years old when they passed away. Their 80s. They died hours apart on the same day, which was the 4th of July. I forget which day. I should have looked that up, but which year. But let me read this, and possibly it'll inspire you, because there is very few greater minds, greater genius. Especially in the founding fathers, who was greater than Thomas Jefferson, and he's respected, I think, by most Americans, though most Americans don't truly understand him or what he stood for. And his Republican Party that he established is no Republican Party anymore. In fact, he's probably turning over in his grave thinking about it. But let me go on. I'm going to read this tonight, and then I have another by Emerson that I want to read called The Spirit. And let me go here. First inaugural address, March 4th, 1801, by Thomas Jefferson. Friends and fellow citizens, called upon to undertake the duties of the first executive office of our country, I avail myself of the presence of that portion of my fellow citizens which is here assembled to express my grateful thanks for the favor with which they have been pleased to look toward me, to declare a sincere consciousness that the task is above my talents, and that I approach it with those anxious and awful presentiments which the greatness of the charge and the weakness of my powers so justly inspire. A rising nation spread over a wide and fruitful land, traversing all the seas with a rich production of their industry, engaged in commerce with nations who feel power and forget right, advancing rapidly to destinies beyond the reach of mortal eye. When I contemplate these transcendent objects and see the honor and happiness and the hopes of this beloved country committed to the issue and the auspices of this day, I shrink from the contemplation and humble myself before the magnitude of the undertaking. Utterly, indeed, should I despair, did not the presence of many whom I here see remind me that in the other high authorities provided by our Constitution, I shall find resources of wisdom, of virtue, and of zeal, on which to rely under all difficulties. To you, then, gentlemen, who are charged with the sovereign functions of the legislation, and to those associated with you, I look with encouragement for the guidance and support which may enable us to steer with safety the vessel in which we are all embarked amid the conflicting elements of a troubled world. During the contest of opinion through which we have passed, the animation of discussion and of exertions have sometimes worn an aspect which might impose on strangers unused to think freely and to speak and to write what they think. But this being now decided by the voice of the nation, announced according to the rules of the Constitution, all will, of course, arrange themselves under the will of the law and unite in common effort for the common good. All, too, will bear in mind this sacred principle that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will to be rightful must be reasonable, that the minority possess their equal rights, which equal laws must protect, and to violate which would be oppression. Let us then, fellow citizens, unite in one heart and one mind. Let us restore to social intercourse that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things. And let us reflect that having banished from our land the religious intolerance under which mankind so long bled and suffered, we have yet gained little if we countenance a political intolerance as despotic, as wicked, and capable of as bitter and bloody persecutions. During the throes and convulsions of the ancient world, during the agonizing spasms of infuriated man, seeking through blood and slaughter, has long lost liberty. It was not wonderful that the agitation of the billows should reach each distant and peaceful shore, that this should be more felt and feared by some and less by others, that this should divide opinions as to measures of safety. But every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. If there be any among us who would wish to dissolve this union or to change this Republican form, let them stand undisturbed as monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left free to combat it. I know, indeed, that some honest men fear that a Republican government cannot be strong, that this government is not strong enough. But would the honest patriot, in the full tide of successful experiment, abandon a government which has so far kept us free and firm on the theoretic and visionary fear that this government, the world's best hope, may by possibility want energy to preserve itself? I trust not. I believe this on the contrary. The strongest government on earth, I believe it is the only one where every man, at the call of the laws, would fly to the standard of the law and would meet invasions of the public order as his own personal concern. Sometimes it is said that man cannot be trusted with the government of himself. Can he, then, be trusted with the government of others? Or have we found angels in the forms of kings to govern him? Let history answer this question. Let us then, with courage and confidence, pursue our own federal and republican principles, our attachment to our union and representative government. Kindly, separated by nature and wide ocean from the extreme, exterminating havoc of one quarter of the globe, too high-minded to endure the degradations of the others, possessing a chosen country, with room enough for our descendants to the 100,000th generation, entering a due sense of eternal right to the use of our own facilities, our faculties rather, to the acquisition of our industry, to honor and confidence from our fellow citizens, resulting not from birth, but from our actions and their sense of them, enlightened by a benign religion, professed indeed and practiced in various forms, yet all of them, including honesty, truth, temperance, gratitude, and the love of man, acknowledging and adoring an overruling providence, which by all its dispensations proves that it delights in the happiness of man here and his greater happiness hereafter. In all these blessings, what more is necessary to make us a happy and prosperous people? Still one thing more, fellow citizens, a wise and frugal government. We shall restrain men from injuring one another. We shall leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government, and this is necessary to close the circle of our felicities. About to enter, fellow citizens, on the exercise of duties which comprehend everything dear and valuable to you, it is proper that you should understand what I deem the essential principles of our government, and consequently those which ought to shape its administration. I will compress them within the narrowest compass they will bear, in stating the general principles, but not all its limitations. Equal and exact justice to all men of whatever state or persuasion, religious or political, peace, commerce, and honest friendship in all nations, entangling alliances with none. The support of the state governments in all their rights as the most competent administrations for our domestic concerns, and the surest bulwarks against anti-republican tendencies. The preservation of the general government in its whole constitutional vigor, as the sheet anchor of our peace at home and safety abroad, a jealous care of the right of election by the people, a mild and safe corrective of abuses which have lopped by the sword of the revolution, where peaceable remedies were unprovided. Absolute acquiescence in the decision of the majority, the vital principles of republics from which there is no appeal but to force, the vital principles and immediate parent of despotism, a well-disciplined militia, our best reliance in peace and for the first moments of war, till regulars may relieve them, the supremacy of the civil over the military authority, economy in the presence in the public expense, the labor may be lightly burdened, the honest payment of our debts, and sacred preservation of the public faith, encouragement of agriculture and of commerce as its handmaid, the diffusion of information, and the arrangement of all abuses at the bar of public reason, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of person under the protection of the habeas corpus, and trial by juries impartially selected. And these principles form the bright constellation which has gone before us and guide our steps through an age of revolution and reformation. The wisdom of our sages and the blood of our heroes have been devoted to their attainment. They should be the creed of our political faith, the text of civil instruction, the touchstone by which to try the services of those we trust. And should we wander from them in moment of error or alarm, let us hasten to retrace our steps and to regain the road which alone leads to peace, liberty, and safety. I repair then, fellow citizens, to the post you have assigned me, with experience enough to subordinate officers to have seen the difficulties of this, and greatest of all, I have learned to expect what it will rarely fall to the lot of imperfect man to retire from this station with the reputation and the favor which bring him into it. Without pretension to that high confidence reposed in our first and great revolutionary character, whose preeminent services had enlightened him to the first place in his country's love and destined for him the fairest page in the volume of faithful history, I ask so much confidence only as may give firmness and effect to the legal administration of your affairs. I shall often go wrong through defect of judgment. When right, I shall often be thought wrong by those whose positions I will not command a view of the whole ground. I ask your indulgence for my own errors, which will never be intentional, and your support against the errors of others who may condemn what they would not if seen in all its parts. The approbation implied by your suffrage is a consolation to me for the past, and my future solicitude will be to retain the good opinion of those who have bestowed it in advance, to conciliate that of others by doing them all the good in my power, and to be instrumental to the happiness and freedom of all. Relying then on the patronage of your goodwill, I advance with obedience to the work, ready to retire from it whenever you become sensible how much better choice it is in your power to make. And may that infinite power, which rules the destinies of the universe, lead our counsels to what is best, and give them a favorable issue for your peace and prosperity. And that was Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural address in 1801. And what a truly humble address, and yet at the same time hopeful. A young country and one of its founders. able to grasp that vision beyond me, but also to remember that the times there was a man who had, I mean, he didn't talk about a bipolar personality. I mean, when he talks about the freedoms and dignity of man, and yet he's holding slaves. You know, right? And yet, I don't know, I guess that dichotomy, that double personality that we all live through, we all have in some degree, was able to create vision for many generations up to now. And I think America has lost its vision, that vision of Jefferson, by these interests, these outside interests that are forever playing against us and against the good. No, I believe that there is a God, as I believe Jefferson believed, though he was a deist. He believed in more of an indifferent God, and perhaps he was right. In some ways, a man more or less is the maker of his future, and his destiny. Jefferson was not a man who ever believed in knowledge, wisdom, and wisdom of all sorts. Science. He was a scientist. He was a genius, just a genius. And we must respect that, and I think every man does to some degree, who is an American. But Jefferson was also an extremely radical individual. And he stated, and many will remember, that every government should have a revolution, every country should have a revolution every 20 years to clean it out. And it's true. It's true. And perhaps it is. In some way, every 20 years we go through some kind of a cleansing, but for the excesses in this country. But the problem is, and I say this with all sincerity, the problem is the number of, by losing sight of the dignity of man, by losing sight of the spirit of man, we allow the dark side of our personalities to take over, to obsess, to digress into this void of never-ending conflict and whatnot, and greed, and just an indifference to each other, and an anger with each other. And you know, people will sell each other out for so little, just because they don't like one another, just because they don't like the color of your skin or the color of your hair, or your religion, or your views. They could care less. But much as I dislike these fools who, make mandates on everyone, or who will lead this country into, it's like, I don't know, probably, I just can't understand how anybody could vote for somebody who insists on bringing us back to the worst administration in the history of this country, which was Bush, G.W. Bush, where we just came out of two stolen elections. A horrible, horrible group of neocons, of people that were had nothing to this country other than to steal and rob from the people and put them into war and, give to the banks and the corporations and let them steal and steal and rob and rob. But to go back to that, it's absolutely frightening. It shows how stupid and ignorant the American public is, or at least those who isolated few who can't see. I, for the first time in my life, my voting life, refused to vote in this midterm election. I couldn't do it. I couldn't bring myself to vote for the candidates that they were running. They're all corrupt. They're all horrible. That's not a statement that I'm making from nowhere. I mean, to see and understand what these candidates are capable of and what they've already done and what their records show, how could anybody possibly vote for them? Or even allow them to become viable candidates where you're forced to vote for them. So it tells you something about the system here. It tells you something about how bad this system is. Now, there was a two-party system. They were Federalists and Republicans, okay? Believe it or not, Thomas Jefferson, Republicanism is more what the Democrats are today. The Federalists are what the Republicans are today. So, you'll never see a GOP flaunting that Lincoln was a Republican or that Jefferson was a Republican, because Lincoln and Jefferson believed in totally the opposite of what the Republican Party believes in today. These were great, great men. Great men who had great challenges. I mean, to compare a man like Lincoln or Jefferson to a man like G.W. Bush is like comparing gold to human excrement. It's just like there's no comparison. From Albert Einstein to, Forrest Gump, right? And that's what we're dealing with here. And that's how low the parties have become. I mean, Jefferson would never tolerate what's going on today. He'd say, wipe it out. Destroy the system. Wipe it out. Start anew. The spirit and the ideal that, this country was founded upon originally. To make the sacrifices of the heroes and the early revolutionary spirit. Make it alive again. Make it well. Make it revive it. you will, just imagine how wonderful it would be if Obama would say this, could have said this, you know, in his first year, his first address to Congress. This is Thomas Jefferson again, for those of you who might just be joining me. His first annual message to Congress. Fellow citizens of the Senate and House of Representatives, it is a circumstance of sincere gratification to me that on meeting the great council of our nation, I am able to announce to them on the grounds of reasonable certainty that the wars and troubles which have for so many years afflicted our sister nations have at length come to an end, and that the communications of peace and commerce are once more open among them. While we devoutly return thanks to the benefit, our beneficent being, who has been pleased to breathe into them the spirit of conciliation and forgiveness, we are bound with peculiar gratitude to be thankful to him that our own peace has been preserved through so perilous a season, and ourselves permitted quietly to cultivate the earth and to practice and improve those arts which tend to increase our comforts. The assurances, indeed, of friendly disposition received from all the powers with whom we have principal relations had inspired a confidence that our peace with them would not have been disturbed. But a cessation of the irregularities which had affected the commerce of neutral nations and of the irritations and injuries produced by them cannot but add to this confidence and strengthens all the same time the hope that wrongs committed on unoffending friends under a pressure of circumstances will now be reviewed with candor and will be considered as founding just claims of retribution for the past and new assurance of the future. And it goes on, but there's such a reconciliation of kind of hope and thing that said we are no longer at war, nor are our countrymen at war with each other, or our sister countries, meaning France and in the time I have remaining, I'm going to try to get through this short, I'll read this short essay by Emerson. It's called Spirit. Ralph Waldo Emerson. It is essential to a true theory of nature and of man that it should contain somewhat progressive uses that are exhausted or that may be, and facts that end in the statement cannot be all that is true of this brave lodging wherein man is harbored and wherein all his faculties find appropriate and endless exercise. And all the uses of nature admit of being summed in one, which yields the activity of man in infinite scope. Through all its kingdoms, to the suburbs and outskirts of things, it is faithful to the cause whence it had its origin. It always speaks of spirit. It suggests the absolute. It is a perpetual effect. It is a great shadow pointing always to the sun behind us. The aspects of nature is devout, yet or like the figure of Jesus, she stands with bended head and hands folded upon the breast. The happiest man is he who learns from nature the lessons of worship. Of that ineffable essence, which we call spirit, he that thinks most will say least. And we can foresee God in the course and, as it were, distant phenomenon of matter. But when we try to define and describe himself, both language and thought desert us, and we are as noblest ministry of nature is to stand as the apparition of God. It is the organ through which the universal spirit speaks to the individual and strives to lead back the individual to it. When we consider spirit, we see that the views already presented do not include the whole circumference of man. We must add some related thoughts. Three problems are put by nature to the mind. What is matter? Whence is it? And where to? The first of these questions only the ideal theory answers. Idealism saith, matter is a phenomenon, not a substance. Idealism acquaints us with the total disparity between the evidence of our own being and the evidence of the world's being. And the one is perfect, the other incapable of any assurance. The mind is a part of the nature of things. The world is a divine dream, and from which we may presently awake to the glories and certainties of day. Idealism is a hypothesis to account for nature by other principles than those of carpentry and chemistry. Yet if it only deny the existence of matter, it does not satisfy the demand of the spirit. It leaves God out of me. It leaves me in the splendid labyrinth of my perceptions to wander without end. Then the heart resists it because it balks the affections in denying substantive being to men and women. Nature is so pervaded with human life that there is something of humanity in all and in every particular. But this theory makes nature foreign to me and does not account for that consanguinity which we acknowledge to it. Let it stand, then, in the present state of our knowledge, merely as a useful introductory hypothesis serving to apprise us of the eternal distinction between the soul and the world. But when following the invisible steps of thought, we come to inquire, whence is matter, and where to? Many truths arise to us about the recesses of consciousness. We learn that the highest is present to the soul of man, that the dread universal essence, which is not wisdom, or love, or beauty, or power, but is all in one, and each entirely, is that for which all things exist, and that by which they are, that spirit creates, that behind nature, throughout nature, spirit is present, not and not compound. It does not act upon us without, upon us from without, that is in space and time, but spirituality, or through ourselves. Therefore, the spirit that is the supreme being does not build up nature around us, but puts it forth through us, as the life of the tree puts forth new branches and leaves through the pores of the old. As a plant can upon the earth, so a man rests upon the bosom of God, and he is nourished by unfailing fountains and draws at his need an inexhaustible power. Who can set bounds to the possibilities of man? Once inhale the upper air, being admitted to behold this absolute natures of justice and truth, and we learn that man has access to the entire mind of the Creator, is himself the Creator in the infinite or in the finite. This view, which admonishes me where the source of wisdom and power lie and points to virtue as to the golden key which opens the palace of eternity, carries upon its face the highest certificate of truth, because it animates me to create my own world through the purification of my soul. And the world proceeds from the same spirit as the body of man. It is a remoter and inferior incarnation of God, a projection of God in the unconsciousness, or in the unconscious. But it differs from the body in one important respect. It is not like that now subjected to the human will. It is serene, order inviolable to us. It is, therefore, to us the present expositor of the of the divine mind. It is a fixed point whereby we may measure our departure. As we degenerate, the contrast between us and our house is more evident. We are as much strangers in nature as we are aliens from God. And we do not understand the notes of birds. The fox and the deer run away from us. The bear and the tiger rend us. We do not know the uses of more than a few plants, as corn and apple and potato and vine. It is not the landscape, every glimpse of which hath a grandeur, a face of him. Yet this may show us that the discord is between man and nature, for you cannot freely admire a noble landscape if laborers are digging in the field hard by. The poet finds something ridiculous in his delight until he is out of the sight of men. And I don't know, perhaps that needs a little clarification, perhaps not, but it's something that maybe I read that tonight because, and I read the works of Jefferson, the inauguration, first inauguration, because I wanted to find some compromise. I hate that word, but that's basically what it comes down to, is a compromise between what I've witnessed recently with the absurdity and the insanity of our political system here in the United States, and yet the overall spirit of its people. And perhaps if I can overlook the arrogance and the belligerence and the pettiness of our current leaders in Congress and the White House, then I have to believe that there's something in the spirit, the original spirit that this country was founded upon, that of the inevitable goodness of mankind to achieve the greatest heights that he can achieve by his own works and by his own, with the aid of his government, but in the sense of defending him from outside enemies and by protecting him in as many ways as it can, but not overly encroaching upon his individual life. And that's what we have today. We have a government that is extremely intrusive, and this is not by design of a liberal government, if you will. This is by design of of the last 10 years, by design of an incredibly cruel and callous and inconsiderate, uncaring group of people that we know as the Republicans. Okay? Which is far not from what Jefferson was. So, to conclude tonight, I just want to say, I'll repeat that what I said prior about the essence, or possibly the survival of our nation, is not so much in the individual leadership or fragments thereof, but it is in the overall spirit of cooperation, or at least the spirit, identifying that spirit and allowing that spirit that created this nation to be the virtues, but, you know, to the old ways, and to the constitutional constraints that were put in place to restrain and hold back the authority of government and the power of government. And but unfortunately, we're now at a point where all three checks and balances are no longer holding up. They've been overridden by corporate greed and corrupt Supreme Court justices and congressmen and presidents. Corruption, regardless of how strong our Constitution is, corruption for any great length of time by people who are dedicated to destroying their country, which George W. Bush was, as was Roe, as was Clinton, as was all these others, by proof of their actions, right? By approving NAFTA or dragging us into the wars that were, you know, by people who did nothing to us. And this 9/11 is proven time and time again over the last 10 years that Bush and Cheney and all of his minions were responsible for this, okay, and the death of 3,000 people and more now, that far overshadowed the original death toll of those who died in the World Trade Center. I mean, we've lost in excess of 5,000 or 6,000 of our own soldiers, wounded over 40,000 of our own soldiers, 50,000 and growing every day in Iraq and Afghanistan and other countries that we're in. And, you know, robbed our treasury of $3-4 trillion over the last 10 years that has virtually bankrupted our country, as well as other countries around the world that depended upon our currencies, you know, and our leadership. So we are at the crossroads now of begging the cosmos. I say that in the most serious way. We're begging on our knees that the cosmos and the higher knowledge God save this country, save its people from horrible leadership. And, you know, we hope and we pray, or at least I hope and pray that that will happen. But, again, I'm liberal, and I believe in the good of mankind, or at least the potential good of mankind. The reason I say that is because I believe that I can be better than I am, that I could not do these atrocities, that I could not allow myself to hate so much, to be so brought down that I could no longer function any other way other than off with their heads. You know? And I've gotten to that. You know, those of you who have read my writings on Facebook or my website or my book, you know, naked at the mic. I've been there. I've done that. I've said that. And I don't take any of those things back. I was very angry when I wrote them, and I was very concerned. And I still am. And, you know, and I've offended many people in that book. I know. But those people had to be offended because they were the culprits. They were the ones that are creating the illusions. They are the ones who are feasting off the suffering and sacrifices of the rest of the world. I heard yesterday, or the day before yesterday, that in the last 30 years, ever since Reaganomics and the conservative tax cuts and so on and so forth, top 5% of this country went from $4 trillion, they owned $4 trillion, top 5%, to my own $4 trillion back in 1950s, 60s, 70s. Today, the top 5% own $40 trillion. $40 trillion. Went up from $4 trillion to $40 trillion, okay, in the last 30 years under this administration, the Republican and conservative-controlled administrations and Congresses. So, you know, the poverty that has been increased under this group has been phenomenal. And the wealth to the extreme 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% of this country's people is concentrated into the wealth of just a handful of people. $40 trillion. This gentleman said that if you were to take if you were to tax that 4% or 5% of the people, increase their tax rate by 10 or 15%, which was bring it back to pre George Bush tax cut times, all right? Bring it back to Clinton tax. You would bring in about $4 or $5 trillion to this economy. Imagine that, $4 to $5 trillion. What that would do to our economy, it would bring it right back to normal. It would bring it better than normal. It would reduce our deficit. It would eliminate our deficit and pay off our entire debt. We would be debt free, right? Just by raising the tax on the top 5% of the wage earners, they don't get wages. But the top 5% would eliminate all of our debt. I mean, imagine that within the first year. So, you know, it's time for us to rethink this over. As far as Republicans, they're a damned disgrace to the world. Disgrace to the nation. And Thomas Jefferson is rolling over in his grave, and I guarantee he would deny you and condemn you for what you do. Probably condemn this nation for what it's become and call for a revolution again. And I stand 100% behind the men. So, with those words, I'll end tonight's show. Hope you enjoyed it. I want to thank you. And in the words of Thomas Jefferson, I'm sure somewhere down the line he said goodnight. So,